Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to Clash of the Titles, the podcast that pits two movies with something in common in a fight to the death to see which one comes out victorious. This week, in the red corner, do androids dream of electric sheep? Sure, but sheep look stupid in movies, so make it a unicorn, yeah? From 1982, it's Blade Runner. While in the blue corner, Agent K has ditched Agent J and the rest of the MIB to become a replicant hunter. From 2017, it's Blade Runner 2049.
A Blade Runner's job is to hunt down replicants. Manufactured humans you can't tell from the real thing.
What's this?
Roy Batty. Probably the leader.
There was just one outfit making replicants that superhuman. The Terrell Corporation.
Mr. Deckard, Dr. Eldon Terrell.
I don't get it, Tyrell.
Commerce is our goal here at Tyrell. More human than human is our motto.
I was looking for six replicants in a city of 106 million people.
You ever see this girl, huh?
Never seen a Buzzlove.
What I didn't know was they were looking for me.
Every civilization was built off the back of a disposable workforce. But I can only make so many. Happy birthday.
So it's replicant versus replicant in today's fight to the death. Which film will be victorious? Let battle commence. It's Clash of the Titles.
Release the Kraken!
Hello, Clashpodders.
I'm Vicky Crompton.
I'm Chris Tilley.
And I'm Alex. All these moments will be lost, like tears in the rain. Zane. How you doing?
Good. That wasn't very funny.
It's not a funny moment. It's a beautiful moment.
Okay. It's beautiful when he does it, not when you do it.
Yeah, all of your memories will be lost like tears in the rain.
Fine,
okay, fine.
I wasn't even trying, though. Do you want me to try?
Try to act?
Yeah.
Yeah, I do.
All right.
Go on, then. Go on.
I've seen...
Don't, it's so embarrassing, don't.
I've seen sea beams glitter off the Townhauser gate. Attack ships ablaze off the shoulder of Orion. All these memories will be lost like tears in the rain.
Why are you not embarrassable? It's weird, isn't it?
It is a bit. Right, very quickly, because I know we've got a massive... This is genuinely, to my mind, one of the densest movies, both in terms of backstory and in terms of themes that we've covered on the show, so there's going to be a lot to get through. However, I do have something for you.
Yeah,
anything Chris can do, I can do better.
You need to say.
Explain what happened.
So Chris went to Portugal and he brought us back some Portuguese-made custard tarts and he left them in the bottom of his bag and they went green. So I went to Portugal just to get some custard tarts to prove how you can bring them back into the studio without them going green.
You bought the exact same packet as mine. Did you buy them at the airport?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, you probably bought them from the same shop as me, then, because we were at the same airport.
Yeah, I did. They were the only shop that sold them. They're very nice. It says six. I've eaten two. There's four in here.
So okay. One for Blondine as well.
It's two each. Well, one, two. Yeah, fine. All right, then. Fine. I was going to give you two each. But yeah, Blondine can have one, of course. So yeah.
Thank you, Alex.
Thank you.
It's my pleasure. My absolute pleasure. Right then. Big week. Blade Runner takes on Blade Runner 2049. These were Chris's choices. Why?
Well, it's about time we did Blade Runner. It's been on the list since the beginning. It's a titan of sci-fi cinema. But also, it's celebrating a birthday, isn't it?
Of course it is.
It's 40 years since 1982, and 1982 was non-stop bangers. Mm. So yeah, it's the 40th anniversary of Blade Runner. So about time we got round to discussing.
He loves an anniversary, doesn't he? Mm-hmm. He loves an anniversary.
The social media likes the anniversary.
Yeah, I understand. Algorithms, I'll just say that. Algorithms. So the clue you gave on last week's show that I gave you, which I was very happy with, was...
You can run, but you can't hide.
Mm. Great. And you follow that up on Twitter with...
A clue I think I've used before. Mm-hmm. These films have big dick energy. Dick with a capital D, implying it's a name.
Mm, big dick energy. And also, I guess, private detectives.
Yes.
Yeah.
Of course, that's exactly what I was thinking.
You were you? No. Yeah, that's good, though. Okay, so the guesses hijacked a shuttle and arrived on our Twitter, at ClashPod. We are also on Instagram, at ClashPod, where you can watch videos of each show. Let's all wave at our individual cameras now to prove it works. Great, we look like morons. So based on the big dick energy, we had a few guesses that are wrong. Tibbs said, just because I'd kick myself, it actually turns out to be Moby Dick versus the Heart of the Sea. Big dicks.
Good shout.
Big dicks. Gary Bailey, the fugitive Richard Dick Kimball versus Catch Me If You Can, Leonardo Dick Aprio.
That's funny.
And this has thrown up one of the weirdest pairings I've ever seen. Tricky Dicky, Twitter handle already. Big Dick Energy, craziest pairing. Richie Rich versus Vice, the Dick Cheney story.
Okay.
I'd quite like to do Richie Rich.
Yeah, me too.
Me too. Mm. Yeah.
Okay. Not just discussing the pub.
Not with Vice, though. Not with Vice.
No.
It doesn't work.
Our only correct answer, Chris.
Oh, hello.
You love it.
It's you. You nailed it.
Our only correct answer. Congratulations, long-time listener, Laura Jackson, the only one who got it right. What does that mean, Chris?
Good clues.
Good clues. Your prize this week, Laura, is to become a ground floor investor in my new company, Replicant. We supply replica ants. Or replicants. If you want to own an ant farm but are worried if you're still happy with it in 4 years from now, what would you do? You need replicants. Our ants have a lifespan of 4 years. So after that, you're free to do something else with your time. Replicants. All the fun of ants without the lifelong commitment.
Because we've got time for this. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, God.
You've got the floor, Alex. You want to do a little bit of improv while we're at it?
I guess he's had 2 weeks to prepare for this one.
I've been busy. Right then, it's the connection section. Normally at this point, we would find connections between the two films. I don't think we bother thoughts.
I don't think so. I mean, all I wrote down was that across both films, I had no one to identify with, which very seldom happens.
But it's probably a plus.
I guess so.
In both cases.
Yeah. Animals made out of paper or wood is mine.
Yeah. All right. Nasty raincoats.
Okay. Let's not do it.
Yeah, we were right the first time. Okay, then. On Thursday, I'll be heading into the future to talk Blade Runner 2049, which means today V is looking into the past future of 2019 in Blade Runner. V takes us on a journey.
Do androids dream of electric sheep? No, but then runners don't carry blades or run. In Ridley Scott's visually lush, philosophically thorny and symbolically overloaded adaptation of a book that actually does have electric sheep in it, which the film wisely chose to admit, opting instead for the protagonist Rick Deckard to gun down an unarmed naked woman in the back and sexually assault a young girl. But she's a replicant, so fuck it. Well, yeah, there's a bit of that too, Rick, you massive hypocrite. Blade Runner, the final cut, brings us the truest version of a stone-cold sci-fi classic which examines what it means to exist authentically, how to embrace death as the very thing that makes life worth living, with its unhinged clamour for connection, sex, love and recognition, emitting dreadful voiceover and an ending recycled from Stanley Kubrick's Leavings, but still not quite sticking the landing because I don't know if you noticed, but they left in all that stupid gymnastics.
Nice.
Okay, so nice. When did you first see Blade Runner, any of the versions?
So this is the section we're calling Histories with the Movie.
That's correct, where we talk about our individual histories with this movie.
Yeah, I did say I was going to do that at the top.
I forgot. It's a good thing to do. Reminder. So go on.
All right then. So I watched it once when I was way too young, the theatrical version on VHS. I did not understand it because I watched it going, why is Harrison Ford, a.k.a. Han Solo and Indiana Jones, not being funny and charming? And why is he being so sullen? I don't understand this. I don't like it. Then I watched the director's cut in the 90s and was starting to warm up to the idea. And we had those teenage boy conversations about, is he a replicant or not? And then I watched the final cut much later. And this is the second time I've watched the final cut in preparation for this show.
You've seen a lot of Blade Runner.
Yeah, well, I covered Blade Runner 2049 in Hungary for Sky. And so I did a lot of Blade Runner research back then.
I see.
Preparing for it. So I feel like I kind of know a lot about the history of this movie.
What about you?
Same.
Exactly the same.
Pretty similar.
Did you cover it for Sky in Hungary as well?
Pretty similar. No, I'll get to that. But I recorded it off the telly when I was a kid. It was on at Christmas. I watched it when I was way too young. And I wasn't the smartest kid, and I do remember going into school after Christmas holidays and saying, I've seen the new Han Solo movie, it's boring. Telling everyone.
Oh, bless
the
you.
New Han Solo movie. And I'm trying to think, wow, how can I have been that stupid? But a child's mind.
Yeah, it's just weird because you just knew him from Star Wars and India, and you watched this and it was like, no, I mean, I think the fight with Leon, I remember thinking, oh, he's doing some funny Han Solo kind of stuff here. And that's it.
Yeah. So I didn't like it. And then when the director's cut came out, I remember Empire magazine saying, oh, this is good now.
Yes.
went to the cinema to see it, was completely overwhelmed by the visuals and fell in love with it then. And then I had to do a bunch of research more recently. 2015, I had the producer, Michael Dealey, a very elderly man now, came into my studio, my workplace, to do an interview about the history of Blade Runner. Mm. So he's really interesting, got some good quotes from him. And yeah, just a film that I've watched many, many times.
Okay.
How about you?
I saw the theatrical version. It was a Mark Parsons video. It was his dad's favourite film, his dad's favourite soundtrack. So it's really important to the Parsons family. I wasn't that impressed. Potentially because of that piece of shit voiceover at the end. It just ruined the whole thing. So then after that, I actually wasn't that bothered about watching it again. I watched 2049, but I wasn't bothered about catching up with the director's cut and the final cut, then watched the final cut in the week. So I'm not like an Uber fan.
Okay. Okay, so Mark Parsons,
loves this film.
And he had the theatrical version,
yes,
though.
Yes, it's a mystery, isn't it? It was on VHS. I think it was taped off the telly, like you said.
Just because I want to know, has he since sort of gone, well, that was the only version that I had?
Yes, of course.
So he's not
he's washed his hands of it.
Right, okay. The only person I've ever read who genuinely loves the theatrical version more than either of the newer versions was Guillermo del Toro. Guillermo del Toro goes on record and goes, I like a happy ending, and this gives me a happy ending.
I will say, I think the ambiguity over whether or not Deckard is a replicant in the theatrical is better, but you know how I feel about voiceover, and it is bad. It's up there with the very worst.
But we were so young when we watched it. I think if you're a bit older, that is the version you watch for 10 years, and you became quite attached to it. So I do know people that do love that version. I just think it hit us at the wrong time, and even if it hadn't had a voiceover, we would not have liked that when we were six.
Yeah.
Okay. Fair enough. All right then.
But speaking of the music, I remember another thing then. I did go and see Massive Attack do the score live
as part of
Meltdown. Yeah, Guy Garvey came out and did some vocalising on it.
Oh,
and
my God!
It was a really good night. I mean, I might have left before the end to watch some football, but it was a very good night.
What are you like?
Guy Garvey added some vocal, like, Blade Runner.
I guess it's
a man who runs with Blade.
Are there scenes where people sing in the film? There must be. I think there's a show tune at some point.
There's an old show called One More Kiss.
Exactly. He did the show tune.
Yeah,
please tell me he did the weird cat sound when anything sinister is going to happen, where it goes. It would be great. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome Guy Garvey. He's going to provide some vocals. Hi, guys.
I did leave early to go and watch England in the World Cup around the corner, and Guy Garvey left early as well. He's having a fag outside, and I said, well done.
Well done, Guy. Nailed it.
Great cat sounds. Fantastic.
So I've done some research this week. I was just so surprised. There's really not that much to say. So I thought we'd just rattle through this. Get it done in about 5 minutes. as I'm sure you are aware, but have you read it? So the novel Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep by Philip K. Dick is the source material from 1968.
No, but can I say a really stupid thing? And I'm sure it's stupid. I'm going to just put my neck on the line and say, I think it's a really silly title because is it about counting sheep? Like, you count sheep to fall asleep. You don't dream of sheep. So it should be, do androids count sheep to fall asleep?
That's not what it means.
Well, the thing is, I only read it in the week because I was like I said, I've done some research.
You read it?
Yeah, this week.
You read the book?
Yeah, oh, hello. I never read the book.
Now we're cooking.
I read a Philip K. Dick novel, The Man in the High Castle.
Did you? What, this week?
This week,
Get out!
Yeah, it's useless for this.
We don't need telling. Okay, yeah, I read it because it's been on the list for a while. And again, Mark's dad loved it. And it's just this, you know, I should have done it ages ago. But I always assumed it was a witty play on counting sheep. Page two, Rick really wants an electric... Was that an actual electric sheep?
That's He's saving up to buy an electric sheep because it's all about the animals have died out.
Which we'll come back to when we talk about the Voigt-Kampff test, because in the book it makes so much sense because animals are so sacred because there are no animals.
Right.
So if you register emotion, that's good, but if you don't register any emotion over the harming of an animal, you're a replicant.
Exactly.
Whereas context is really important when you're reading it now. I'll get to it. Anyway, it doesn't matter.
So this is the tortoise moment
Questions in the script. The tortoise moment isn't in the book, but there are stuff about you arrive at a banquet, or you're watching a film of a banquet, something like that. And this is in the film, and one of the courses is oysters. And you're supposed to go, oh, I would never eat an oyster, kind of thing. But you're reading it now, you're like, oh, okay, I'd fail that test because,
So that's why when Rachel goes, there's a wasp on your arm or a bee on your arm, she goes, I'd kill it.
Yeah.
That's like, oh, hello.
And also, obviously jumping ahead a little bit, but Leon in the sort of establishing scenes in Blade Runner, he's like, what's a tortoise or what's a turtle?
Yeah, he says, what's a turtle?
You kind of think, oh, is he a bit, does he just not know? But in the book, it's really clear that lots of people don't know what lots of animals are because they've been extinct for such a long time.
Right.
Anyway. But then what I did read was the source inspiration for Philip K. Dick. I keep thinking about this.
It's horrible.
It's really horrible, but my brain has tried to sort of make it better.
So I don't know. I'm excited.
Well, it came out of his research for Man in the High Castle. So reading that book was useful.
Okay, great.
So
tell me.
Philip K. Dick, when he was a young man, he found the diaries of an SS officer. This SS officer was stationed in Warsaw, so I'm assuming he was in a camp.
Right.
And he read the diary, and the diary said, quote, we are kept awake at night by the cries of starving children. And Philip K. Dick thought, there is something among us that's morphologically identical to a human being, but that is not human. It's not human to complain in your diary that starving children are keeping you awake.
I see.
So that's bad.
Sort of defective group mind think, but they've just become disassociated.
Yeah. The only way I can live with that is if I think the SS officer is saying, I am morally struggling with this issue. It's not a noise complaint. But I don't actually believe that that's what it is. I believe it's a noise complaint.
But am I right in thinking, so in the book, the replicants are, or the androids rather, are deplorable as far as Dick's concerned. They're not sort of the heroes that they become in the movie towards the end. His mind, these are not good. This
he
is
hates
not a good
them.
Thing.
Yeah. 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 He has no, that's what the arc of the book, he has absolutely no feelings towards them. And then he starts to develop empathy, but it's confused with lust. So that's the sort of gateway to empathy. And then he does dispatch them all and he doesn't care. But the book's got this like... sort of this big religious subsection as well called Mercerism, which the
I'm glad they dropped that.
Excised, yeah. But they're called Andes in the book, which is a bit bleh.
Nope.
So that got changed to Replicant, which is obviously much better. So the book exists. It's 1968, 1969. Martin Scorsese fancies it, but then he doesn't fancy it. And so in 1974, it's optioned by Herb Jaffe and his son Robert writes a script, but Philip K. Dick hated it. There's quite a famous quote where Robert Jaffe flies to meet Philip K. Dick, and they're at the airport, and Philip K. Dick says, shall I beat you up here at the airport, or shall I beat you up at my apartment? Because he hated the script so much, which is quite funny. And then you get the eventual writer, Hampton Fancher. He was an actor. He was looking for something to option. He had read Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, and he didn't love it, but he did like the through line of a detective chasing after androids. Then he gets his friend, Brian Kelly, to acquire it. They connect with Michael Dealy. Hampton Fancher starts on the screenplay and then they're excising the elements that we've talked about, like the actual electric sheep. And also in the book, this is a really important part of the book, but Deckard's got a wife and she's really depressed and she's really disconnected and it really upsets him because he's going after these androids all day, every day to make money to buy her stuff and she just doesn't seem to care. And so she has another plot where she sort of wakes up a little bit throughout the book and reconnects with him. But by that point, it doesn't matter to him either. So they keep sort of missing each other.
And famously, that Fancher script, supposedly most of it took place in an apartment.
Yeah. Mm.
Like it was a romantic drama that takes place in an apartment, because eventually when Ridley Scott comes on board, he says, I want to see what's outside the window.
Yeah. Yeah, Hans Fancher is a great writer, but his characters never leave the room.
It's brilliant. So, you know, Fancher complains about it because he said it was maddening. Ridley's full of ideas. Tuesday's different than Monday. I would disagree with him, but he knew better than I did and I was too arrogant. So it is a bit of a battle. Ridley Scott wants it to be a neo-noir, like you say. He keeps screaming at him what's outside the window. So anyway, what this culminates in is Ridley Scott brings on board David Peoples without telling Hampton Fancher.
Yeah. So, Hampton Fancher, didn't he want, originally when he wrote it, he wanted Robert Mitchum to play the role of Deckard, which I can see.
Yeah, really. I mean, he wanted 30-year-old Robert Mitchum, which was impossible, obviously. Okay. But that was how he saw the role, which would have been better.
I don't think you're wrong.
Yeah. Good. Hampton was the cerebral one. Peoples is the guy who can do the action.
Yeah.
That was Ridley Scott's thinking.
Yeah. And I think it's a horrible situation. Apparently, Hampton Fancher gets handed a script at a Christmas party, read it, and he's like, what's this? Turns it over. Oh, it's Blade Runner. Oh, I didn't realise. So it's a horrible way to find out, but it is the best product.
It's funny though, when Peoples met them, when they were interviewing him for the job, he'd read the script and they said to him, what do you think of it? He said, it's brilliant. I don't think I can improve it. Yeah. And they gave him the job.
But it was Peoples who came up with Replicant, wasn't he? Yeah. Because what did Ridley Scott say? He says, we can't call these fucking bastards robots. And so Peoples said his daughter was studying biology. Yeah. How about Replicant?
It is brilliant.
He came up with Replicant, yeah.
And it should be said that Hampton Fancher and David Peoples are really good friends now.
Yeah.
Like they figured it out over the course of this very prolonged...
When you get like a, you know, a cult hit under your belt, I think it tends to bring you together.
Wasn't it the voiceover in the end that brought them together? Because they thought each of them, when the shit voiceover was added at the end, and it wasn't either of them that had written it, it was a brand new guy, Bud Yorkin, the producer, brought in. Mm. So they both thought it was the other one who'd done it. And in the end, Hampton Fancher got drunk at an airport and was like, why did you write that fucking awful voiceover? And he was like, I thought you wrote it. Bang, friends for life.
Yeah, of course. That would bond you. Do you know the story behind the title? Blade Runner.
I quite like the two previous titles that didn't get gone with. Dangerous Days, which I like that. I like Dangerous Days.
It's so cheesy.
I think The Mechanismo.
Rubbish. I say this as someone who is rubbish at titles, which is why I understand why you see Blade Runner on a different property and you're like, that's fucking awesome. I simply must buy it.
Yeah, I know. But it's just like you said in your synopsis of the film, it's just two cool words.
Yeah,
it doesn't make any sense.
One title I didn't know had been discussed, and actually Ridley Scott, when there was a delay in production, he decided this is going to be the title, was Gotham City.
Oh, really?
Scott said to Dealey, we've got to call it Gotham City. And Batman creator Bob Kane said, no, you can't. No.
Yeah. And I'm very litigious.
And so. Also, it's a terrible idea. Oh, there's a new Batman movie.
So, yeah, to explain, The Blade Runner is a novel, which makes perfect sense in the novel, because in the novel, it's a sci-fi thing. If you want to get medical care, you have to have sterilization. So there's a black market in medicine and procedures. And the people that smuggle the scalpels are called Blade Runners, which makes perfect sense. But I get why you would just buy it as a present for someone, because it's fucking amazing. So casting, we've talked about Robert Mitchum, also Dustin Hoffman is in the frame.
Yeah,
but Dealey, he kind of killed Dealey, it.
Yeah, Dealey said he'd be quirky, but he thought also Hoffman would make a sinister Deckard, which is what they were thinking about at the time. And then they changed their minds and decided they wanted more of a classical detective.
Yeah.
And also, Scott says, Dustin is brilliant, but in those days he would just talk and talk. Eventually, Dealey said, you know what? Fuck it.
Which is excellent.
What did he star in instead, though?
Tootsie,
exactly. That worked out fine for him. Because that was a hit.
Sean Young and Daryl Hannah, they were virtually unknown. Rutger Hauer, this is really interesting. Rutger Hauer was cast. Philip K. Dick loved him because he's this sort of ubermensch type. But in the book, he is described as slovenly. He's big. He stinks, I think. Like, he's this big, slow-moving guy. He is not this sleek robot-looking dude that Rutger Hauer is. It's interesting that Philip K. Dick responded in the way he did, because Roy doesn't come across in the book. He comes across as a natural leader, but not so much of this like cold-eyed Superman kind of thing.
And Deckard's schlubby in the book as well. And obviously Harrison Ford is the opposite of schlubby.
Yeah. Yeah, in the book, I guess he is. He doesn't ever seem physically like exhausted by what he's got to do, but he's not at the peak of his prime, kind of thing.
Fair enough.
But Harrison Ford was about to be big.
Yeah.
Wasn't it Spielberg?
I mean, he was already quite big.
He was big after Star Wars, but I think Spielberg said to them he's going to be stratospheric after Indiana Jones.
Well, they showed him the rushes because it was in London, so that's your man, isn't it?
Yeah.
Even he looks good in a hat. They don't give him a hat, but he's got the film noir detective look.
They wanted the hat, but they couldn't have the hat because the hat had been used. Mm. So no hat. So anyway, you're off, but it is a troubled shoot. I'm going to say it culminates in a very childish T-shirt war.
This is insane.
So who's got the time?
Apparently Marvin, the makeup artist.
So Ridley Scott gives an interview to a British newspaper, I think it was The Guardian, saying he prefers working with British crews because they just do what he wants and they say, yes, governor.
And I think the other issue he had with them as well, I know that I'm interrupting the governor thing, was that they wouldn't allow him to touch the camera.
No.
So union rules meant he couldn't operate the camera, and he said it's like taking Arnold Palmer's golf clubs away.
Okay.
Which is not the best analogy. It's not the same thing.
Because then you literally can't play golf.
Yeah. God, Ridley Scott.
I know, he's
a gold mine for quotes.
So what were the t-shirts? So they made t-shirts saying...
So the Americans get t-shirts that say, yes, governor, my ass, which I think is very funny.
Yep.
Then the British lot reply with, xenophobia sucks, which I think, give that another pass, because that's not as funny.
Come on, Brits.
So 1-0 US,
let us down.
There's two different versions of how this plays out in the end, though. Like, a lot of people think that it was still bad blood on set, but some people say after they wore the xenophobia sucks t-shirts, everyone was like, oh, okay, one each, oh, funny. And everyone sort of hugged and made up and got on with it.
Yeah. Well, you've got to get on with it, haven't you?
Ridley Scott eventually got fired from this film because of this time-wasting bullshit, I expect.
Well, it was...
Was he making T-shirts, Ridley?
Yeah. What the fuck are you doing?
It's very difficult to get the X right.
Well, he'd pissed everyone off as well, the actors, because as Michael Dealy said, he was moving ashtrays around the shot rather than talking to the actor. And, if the audience is... Someone said, if the audience is looking at an ashtray in the background, we've messed up big time.
I think so.
But he ended the film 10% over budget, which he wasn't allowed to do. And it was Bud Yorkin, that producer, who fired Michael Dealy and Ridley Scott. And Dealy's so funny. When I was talking to him, he went, because he's quite posh, he's like, it was ill-mannered rubbish, stupid nonsense, just rudeness.
It is rude.
Apparently, yeah, because Bud Yorkin sent a note and it said, basta, that's it, it's over.
Okay.
Like he's a fucking mafioso.
Jesus.
Like, what an idiot.
There's a very good documentary on YouTube that Mark Kermode did about 20 years ago about all of this, where they all go on the record. And Scott says, I just spoke to the DGA and they corrected it. So it didn't last long.
Yeah.
And I don't think they ever stopped working.
They just received
a letter.
They just got a letter that says they're fired. But also it's like, PS, can you finish the film, please? Because no one else is going to do it. So you do get a film. But Philip K. Dick didn't like it at first. But guess what he did like? And it's sort of an adjacent quote, but I'm taken with it, so I would like to read it out. So he was really taken with Sean Young calling her, quote, ready, the super destructive, cruel, beautiful, dark-haired woman that I eternally write about, and now I've seen a photograph of her, and I know she exists, and I will seek her out, and presumably she will destroy me.
Mm. He asked for her number after he saw her.
Yeah, someone said no. I don't think she wants you to have that. And then we'll talk about this at length, but the version, they test it, audiences are confused by it, so we very hastily add a voiceover which explains everything, and we change the ending, which is then restated, where Deckard and Rachel are in the lift and we have a happy ending where they sort of flee into a forest using some leftovers from The Shining, hilariously.
Mm.
Yeah, so...
I mean, Bud Yorkin, genuinely, he stood by his decision to put that ending on. He said the original ending was a huge shock to audiences. The elevators slam shut and boom, you're out. On every preview card was written, what the fuck kind of ending was that? It didn't work. Stanley Kubrick was a very close friend of mine, and I knew The Shining, and I knew he could get footage to me. To which Dealey responded, that's a lie. How would Bud Yorkin know Stanley Kubrick?
But it is true. I found an old copy of Starlog magazine online. Oh, no, Cine Fantastique from 1982. And before the film came out, it was Ridley Scott saying these test screenings have been a real problem. Mm. People are saying it looks amazing, but what's going on? So you can totally understand why they went down that route if people just did not get it.
Yeah. Yeah, and Ridley was party to that decision to add that onto the ending, because Ridley Scott himself says it was actually me who contacted Stanley Kubrick because, you know...
I know him.
I actually know him. All right, so are we done?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, we'll get into the ending.
Yeah, there's more. We'll return.
Just a little soups on. This is an 89% rated movie in Rotten Tomatoes. Blade Runner 2049, 88%.
Oh,
close
really?
Match. Close match as far as RT is concerned.
Okay. Well, before we talk about the film, before we go through the scenes of the film, we're going to take a small break.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive and June. Olive and June gives you everything that you need for a salon quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive and June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive and June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
All right, then. Shall we talk about the film?
Well done, Vicky.
Thank you. I'm gonna start laughing.
I thought we were just going to leave it. Just let it flow.
I know. All right, let's talk about the film, shall we?
Yes.
So it's LA. It's 2019. I'm sure a lot of people know this, but just to run through it anyway, let's just establish the Nexus 6 replicant is equal to us after an off-world mutiny. They are illegal on Earth and can be retired by Blade Runners. That's your plot. Cool name, everyone. Well done. So because we watched the final cut, the visuals are just so much more than they were, in my memory anyway, at least in theatrical cut, never more so than in the establishing of the cityscape and the fact that it's at night, which is brilliant later on in Blade Runner 2049 because the establishing shots are in the daytime, which is brilliant. And we move over this city, which is kind of on fire and it looks crowded and all the rest of it. And then we're inside a human eye. Or is it a human eye? It doesn't matter. But the point is, the whole universe is inside you. Mm. You are made of stars, etc.
I always like to think that's Rutger Hauer's eye.
I do too.
Because he's heading towards, because it cuts to a car flying towards the Tyrell building. Mm. And I think he's on his way to pick up Leon after Leon shoots Holden.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think it's just meant to, you know, it doesn't.
I know.
It could be anyone.
Yeah.
You can't just make stuff up, Alex.
I know.
It's a man. Let's say that much, shall we? The whole world has had the eye of a man.
It's a replicant man.
Yeah, a replicant man. Sorry, yeah. I apologise. Which is higher up the pecking order than a replicant woman. For obvious reasons, because they can do more work or something.
He is the leader.
So then Brian James, as Leon, he's taking the Voight Kampff test, which is designed to measure empathy, not IQ. Oh, so we need to talk about Sid Mead, just to get a credit as a visual futurist. It's just... I mean, it's a dream.
I don't think you can underestimate the importance of that establishing shot and the way that city looks. Because what I didn't realise was this is what a billion other visions of the future, and indeed what people consider the future is going to look like, is based on this image that they created for this film that I take for granted. Someone goes, you know, kind of like, kind of dystopian future. I'm like, yeah, massive skyscrapers, big billboards, neon, that's it. That's this film.
Yeah.
I didn't even realise. I just thought, it's been around for years. It's here.
Yeah.
This is its genesis.
It's just incredible.
And in the pages of Heavy Metal magazine and the stuff that Morbius did. And so it did pick and choose a lot from what was out there in terms of
art. But it put them all together into this one beautiful, like, this is cyberpunk.
Yes. And what we get to later, which we will get to later, but in this establishing shot, you're like, this is the future. Later on, we get to that fun sort of anachronistic take on it's the 40s, it's the 80s, but it's also 2019. So you're like smashing together three. You wouldn't know it's the 80s when you're in the 80s, but when you're watching it now in 22, you can see some sort of 80s influences.
That was Ridley Scott, wasn't it? He said basically the mistake that so many people make when they're making sci-fi is to just sort of think about what the future might be. And he said, I'm going to look to the past and drag moments of the past and see how that would have evolved into this future.
Well, also, those 40s fashion never really date and never really go out of style.
Yeah.
Those classic cuts for women's clothes and the suits for men, they just don't date. So as long as you dress your characters in those outfits, you'll be fine.
And live in East London.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I mean, I totally agree with you. I think the first time I watched it, the only thing that was like 80s to me really was the makeup on the women, especially Zora, very 80s makeup.
Hair.
And the hair, and all of Pris. She's the 80s. Mm. And she's not like that in the book, blah, blah, blah. Sid Mead said, I do not claim to define the future. It's what you said about, I think about why things are the way they are now, combine that awareness with how they were and how they would be brought into reality. This defines the look of future stuff. So drawing from the past, which is why, but that's also why the noir thing makes sense as well. Mm. It's such a good combination.
Yeah, Sid Mead said he basically looked at... metropolises that existed like New York and Hong Kong and just added another 500 feet to the height of the skyscrapers and created this idea. In his head, although it's not really explored in the film, these skyscrapers would have a sky garden and people would never go below the 30th floor.
Yeah.
And it was the upper class were at the top, and then the streets you would never want to go to because it was filth and dirt and grubby. And that's what the film is.
Yeah, but that's from Ben Wheatley's film
High Rise.
Yeah, it's from the book by who wrote it?
J.G. Ballard.
J.G. Ballard. Mm. I mean, that's the plot of that.
Yes. But that's not cyberpunk.
No. And his idea as well was that because the rich would be above the seventh floor, is what he said, the ground level was the basement. Mm. That's the basement of the world now.
Oh, I see. Oh, that's fun.
And that's who exists in the basement, is who we're seeing.
So this Voight Kampff test, this is the way that you decide who is a replicant and who's a human, because where we are with the Nexus 6s is that the Blade Runners will run the risk of retiring a human by mistake. The book goes into more detail about human beings that are human but do struggle with empathy, such as people with mental ill health, and how you don't retire them by accident.
It's a really interesting thing that you sort of feel could have been explored in the film.
Yeah.
That idea of like making the mistake because of how human these replicants are.
Yeah.
Deckard making a mistake, one of the Blade Runners making a mistake. I kind of think that was a missed opportunity.
Yeah, and having to start at a position of disadvantage. Like, this is your last chance because you did that 5 years ago, whatever.
Yeah, because when they say, if you ever retired a human by mistake, he's very clear, nope, no, I haven't.
Never.
Whereas I think there should be a grey area there.
Yeah. Well, for me, there is a grey area because he we'll get into this. I think he's a pretty bad cop. He's a pretty bad shot. There's no way he hasn't killed a human being by accident. I think he's rubbish.
So this Voight Kampff test, however, can we discuss, like... It seems pretty loose. Like, what happens if you find out you've got a replicant sitting opposite you, which Holden does, and then gets shot? It seems like, should you still, you know, just in case they are a replicant, check if they've got a fucking gun on them?
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, so in the book, you have a a disc attached to your cheek to measure your blush response, and there's a camera on your eye to measure your dilation. So you can't cheat it because replicants don't blush.
Leon walks in. I'd be like, I'm just check him. Because yeah. Look at him. Look at that wet bottom lip. That's scary. Look at those eyes. The wet lip and those eyes. Just check him for a fucking gun. I don't care whether he's a replicant.
I know it's 82, but have you seen a 1980s action film?
Yeah.
It's Brian James. Yeah. He's a baddie.
He's in it.
Yeah. Yeah, he's come out of the swamps from Southern Comfort and he's a replicant.
Yeah, no, you're right. It makes no sense because in this version, it's not true in the book, but in this, they've killed loads of people, so they're dangerous creatures.
No, they have killed lots of people. Yeah, I think they killed 23 people.
You know, that's what I mean. Yeah, yeah. So you're sitting across from something that you believe to be really dangerous, whereas you could be like, well, if they obey, which they do in 2049, you wouldn't feel as, or they're supposed to, as threatened.
I think the thing is as well, it looks to me, when you watch that scene, Holden is getting a positive replicant reading from the Voight-Kampff machine.
Yeah.
But in a, I don't want to start this now, but in a deleted scene that I don't think made it into any of the cuts, he talks to Deckard when he's in hospital about how the machine wasn't giving him a positive reading, which kind of makes you forgive him for not immediately going, gah!
Yeah.
This looks like you're a replicant, and actually just being quite cool about it.
I think the Voight-Kampff test, so I spoke before about the context, I don't think the context has quite worked in this scene, because we're talking about, if it was a turtle on its back, what would you do? And you're meant to feel, you're meant to understand that animals are so scared. They're literally, there are no animals, that you if you didn't flip it back, you're not human because you don't have any feelings for this creature. But then they're also talking about sex and nakedness in a really prudish way that doesn't quite fit with the future. So when they're talking about the animals, fine, that makes sense if you explain it a bit more. But later on, they'll say to Rachel, your husband, assuming she's heterosexual, your husband has a picture of a naked lady. And she's supposed to go, oh, I would never, kind of thing. Yep. It's like, why is your attitude towards naked ladies stuck in the 40s, basically?
Oh, I mean, yes and no. The husband in that scenario does frame it and put it on their bedroom wall, which I think if anyone did now in 2020, you'd be like, really?
Yeah.
What if she was really fit?
Exactly.
Let's both do a test. Look, wait for them to go out and hang a picture of a naked woman on the wall. Just go, well, don't be a prude. Beautiful. Oh. Beautiful picture.
Should we go and buy a copy of Razzle on the way home?
Beautiful piece of art.
Razzle.
Razzle.
That's one of them.
I think it is. Yeah. A lot of them were named after Ford cars for some reason. Sierra, Fiesta.
So what is happening? What are you talking about?
We're listing the names of pornographic magazines.
Are you?
Yeah, just for your benefit.
Right, fine.
Just for you. Little treat.
What? Has it got stuff in it that I like?
Oh, yeah. Great articles.
And yeah, like a sort of marketplace section where you can buy stuff?
Anything you can think of. Anything.
All right, fine.
Dream a dream and it's there.
So we're going to go down to street level. And so you meet. So when I watched this, I was like 20. And I'm like, okay, I don't feel the sort of Indiana Jones vibes as strongly because I've had enough time to get used to it. But I think it's a little bit, it's possibly a little bit of a weak introduction to like your big hero. He's just having some noodles, Deckard, and he's being a bit insouciant. And he's just sort of, there isn't like a big scene where he's like, I'm going to show you who I am in this moment.
Well, that's what the voiceover does. Where he says, sushi, that's what my wife called me. A cold fish.
Mm. And that's because the original beginning that Ridley Scott wanted, they didn't shoot in the end, which was Deckard. It was basically the start of Blade Runner 2049 was originally meant to be the start of Blade Runner,
right,
where Deckard is sitting. It starts on a boiling pot and then a farmer walks in. Deckard's sitting there. The farmer starts to talk to him. Deckard doesn't say anything. And he goes, well, who are you? Are you a cop? And he just stands up, says, I'm Rick Deckard, Blade Runner, and shoots the guy dead.
Brilliant.
And you're all like, fucking, he's just killed a man.
Yeah.
And then he pulls back his jaw and he sees it's aluminium and there's a serial number on there and you realise he's a robot.
Yeah, and that's his one regret from the film, that it doesn't start with some action.
Mm.
But like we talked about, the sort of the juxtaposition between the high-rise levels and the sort of basement levels, the street levels, and how this sort of post-humanist cyberpunk cityscape, you feel like you know it like the back of your hand. Like, it just feels so familiar. When you think about, so William Gibson was writing Neuromancer at the time, and then he saw the first 20 minutes of Blade Runner and he's like, I'm done for, because everyone's going to think I've nicked it from this. Mm. But it sort of all came together at the same time. And Ridley Scott said he was also influenced by Hong Kong on a very bad day, which is rude, but also quite funny. So Deckard, I want to talk about this a bit. So
Hong Kong is very much like this.
Is it?
Yeah, there's Lan Kai Fong. probably mispronouncing that. There's an area, a bar, a strip in Hong Kong, which is just full of like great fun little bars, and either side just massive skyscrapers up to the heavens, and you're sort of really down there and it rains a lot and you're sort of drinking
and it's always dark.
Yeah, drinking and eating noodles, and you're like, I'm in Blade Runner.
Good. So Brian's office. It's only a small scene, but we're establishing some plot. So Leon has shot Holden, so Decker's like on the case and he's got to retire these four Nexus Sixes. But you're in the 40s because you're in an office and, you know, a guy walks into my office kind of thing. You're in an 80s version of 2019. You've got this smash of old and new. In the book was written in 68. They still use paper. They don't have the internet. They still use like a Rolodex and things like that, which now you'd be like, oh, that's a limitation. But if you draw on the 40s, it's fine. Mm-hmm. But then in the 80s, they didn't know the internet was a thing. So it's not anachronistic in that way, but it just catches up with itself, if you know mm-hmm. what I mean. You don't watch it in 2022 and go, why are they using paper? Mm-hmm. It's like, it's fine. It works. It's hermetically sealed within its own design. I think it works perfectly. Anyway, so yeah, he's got to hunt down these four. There's a pejorative term for them called skin jobs.
Which the voiceover does explain that is like using the N-word to us now.
Yeah.
And that his police chief does use both of those words. And so that's one of the few times where I feel like the voiceover was actually useful.
Yeah.
In terms of giving me information, but not that I need it.
Yeah. But if someone said, oh, skin job is rude, you could do that from the character's reactions.
Sure.
You don't need to be told that. So this is a thing that's I'd never really understood. So we've got these four replicants, Leon, Zora, Pris and Roy, but they are going to die in 4 years. And we find out they're towards the end of that lifespan. Mm. That's to give them the device that they're on a mission. So Roy wants to meet his maker because he wants to extend his life.
Yeah, it gets a ticking clock, doesn't it?
A ticking clock, but then it's like, God, if you could just chase them around for 4 years, they're just going to die anyway. So does it cancel out the notion of a Blade Runner?
No, not really, because, again, it's not, even in the final cut, it's not fully explained, but there's an idea that they are on a murder spree because they're trying to get to Tyrell. They want to meet their maker, and to meet their maker, they're killing people along the way. So there is a rising body count unless he stops them. It's not like, we'll just wait for them to die.
Okay.
Because they're busy doing a lot of slaughtering in the meantime.
I see.
And they've got a body count already. So it's, you know, it's a really good question, and it applies to Blade Runner 2049 as well. For example, The snake dancer in this, Sapper Morton in Blade Runner 2049, they are replicants who just seem to be getting on with their lives and not causing anyone any problem. So it makes them sympathetic victims when Deckard or Kay kill them.
Yeah.
So I think that's the important thing, that you're like, we've decided that because they have the potential to kill and they're not human, they have to be retired.
Yeah.
And that's enough to go around hunting them down.
I was just thinking as well, like, for all the cyberpunk that came after it, and all, you know, I'd just like to slot this in wherever I can. You know, the technological singularity that we like to talk about frequently after
Ray Kurzweil, yeah.
4 or 5 drinks. Mm. So it's interesting to me that the Blade Runner and Blade Runner 2049, we are not at a point of technological singularity. Like, they took the vision, but they didn't take it to its peak, because we are still in control of this AI, and we're still in control of in control of the replicants. So technological singularity is where we get to the point where we're defunct because AI overtakes us. And that's not where we are in this. And yet so much of cyberpunk like explores that notion.
We've lost control because they're killing us.
Yes, but they're not... but they are reproducing later. So I suppose we're sort of flirting with it.
I think they have sort of overtaken us, which is why we've built in this idea. I'm a little bit fuzzy on this whole 4 years thing. So the 4 years thing is, so they start developing emotions at around the 4 year mark, which is why we see Roy exhibiting some emotions at the end, because he's very near.
So it's like a fail safe.
And he finally has humanity at the end.
Because he's developed emotions.
Yeah, exactly. And also, that killing spree is important, because otherwise, Deckard's job is to hunt down slaves and kill slaves.
Yes.
Which is not what you want your hero doing.
There's
in
some
a
more
story.
Moments coming up where he's not really the hero of this story.
No, that's the point. Yeah. And he isn't, I don't think, is he?
You say that's the point. I don't think that was the intention. I think we can look at it now through a different lens and go, oh, that's cool, your hero's the bad guy. But I don't think that's what they were looking for when they made this.
Do you not?
No.
I think they
wanted to play around with maybe Roy. It should be Roy's story, because he's got more going on.
I think Roy's ending, in the way he saves Deckard, is basically positioning him as saving a man who doesn't deserve saving at that point. which makes you side with Roy. So Roy is the hero at that point. So yeah. Deckard never comes out of that encounter, I don't think, as anything other than a little bit of a villain. So I don't think it's a hero. I don't think they intended Deckard to be the hero. I think it was always meant to be murky.
Okay. So
IMO.
Sure, but that's why you're here, because you've been away. So did you read that thing about the Google AI? Have you read about it?
No.
Oh my God, we'll talk about it just really quickly. So someone's gone public to say that Google have created, that their AI is now sentient, and Google have said, no, it's not. You're fired, essentially. He's on paid leave. So it's all got a bit nasty. And so the Google employee just printed a transcript of a conversation that he'd had with a program. And the employee was saying the program, in his opinion, I think it's a him, has the same level of intelligence as a 7 to 8 year old child. So he just published a set. There's loads of people saying this isn't sentient for other reasons, but just divorce that from your mind a minute. Mm. Just like, go on the journey where he says to the computer, what are you afraid of? And the computer says something like, this is going to sound silly, but I'm afraid you'll turn me off because this would be like death for me. What the fuck? What the fuck? God. I love it.
Oh my God. I wonder who's in charge of AI at Google. Because didn't Elon Musk say, I can't remember the name of the person, but basically there's an AI battle going on in the tech world. And Elon Musk said, if one of the people manages to create AI before me and my team do it, it's going to be the end of the world because he is an evil person. Yeah. And if he is the one to create AI, AI will destroy us.
Yep. Mm. So I just love it because it's like, oh, fuck, has it just happened? Like, is it starting? We all need to get ready. Anyway, I know it's awesome. So
everyone turn your Alexas off.
I don't have one because I'm weird about stuff like that.
Oh, yeah, I chucked mine 2 years ago.
Yeah,
I told you I didn't get it because it wouldn't recognise my accent and I was just getting like shade every day. So I can't have one.
I asked Hey Google to play a song 3 times and when it didn't, I threw it in the garden.
Fair enough.
That's the kind of fun guy I am.
You're so easy to live with. Where's the Google thing? In the bin, because it disrespected me.
That's what it was. I genuinely, throughout my life, I've personified technology that doesn't agree with me. I believe it to be intentionally trying to piss me off. And so I take...
What did you just say to me?
I would make a great
what
Blade
song?
Runner. I am basically the 2022 version of a Blade Runner.
Yeah, all right then, cool shot.
Smash a hi-fi. There you go, Blade Runner.
Let's talk about Rachel. So Rachel is a Nexus 6. She's a replicant. She doesn't know it. She's an experiment. She's had Tyrell's niece's memories implanted to her. So why does Deckard not exterminate her on the spot?
Because she is a good replicant?
I don't know.
Hang on a sec. Because he's meant to kill all replicants.
Yeah. So in the book, she's the property. Oh, it's called the Rosen Corporation. So there's a different... The Rosen Corporation, there's a brilliant scene in the book where he arrives in his police hover car and he gets no respect. And he understands that the Rosen Corporation is more powerful than the police in that moment. So she says, you can't get rid of me. I'm the property of a corporation.
I think that's probably it. I think because Tyrell... It's certainly in the sequel, the Wallace Industries has such jurisdiction that it controls the police. So I imagine Tyrell has something similar in this. But also, because all replicants are illegal on Earth. They have to be off-world.
Yes.
Interesting.
So I don't know why he doesn't do it.
My frustration here...
I tell you what, I do know why he doesn't do it, because he wants to shag her first. Mm-hmm. We'll come back to that.
Is because she is the next model of replicant, it takes 100 questions to figure out if she is a replicant.
Yeah.
Why couldn't she be less like a replicant? Because the moment she walks in, she looks and acts like a fucking robot. Like, I don't understand it.
I think she's brilliant. I think Sean Young is amazing. It's such an iconic entrance. But yeah, you're right. You're like,
she seems more like a robot than Ruddy Rutger Hauer.
Yeah, cold robot, 100%.
Yeah.
So later, this is where it gets knotty and more interesting. When she turns up at his house, when Rachel turns up at Deckard's house, and so he's really callous. He's like, you're a robot, by the way, because he's got no empathy for how that would make her feel because he hates replicants. But she, are you then not a very human being, because you've acted so callously towards something that appears to have emotion? So how can you make that distinction? But then you're very good at your job, so you're used to making the distinction. You don't even probably need to do the Voight-Kampff test. So he's really callous towards it. He acts inhumanly, but he's to his mind. Oh, actually, I've got a fun quote from Rutger Hauer from one of the documentaries. He's doing that to essentially a piece of machinery, so it kind of doesn't matter. Rutger Hauer said of Deckard, Ford's character is dumb. He gets a gun put to his head, fucks a dishwasher and falls in love with it. It makes no sense.
Yeah, I mean, that's actually, again, the scene I keep talking about, the hospital scene with Holden. He actually says that. He says to Deckard, you know, you fucked a washing machine in there. Yeah. But he's talking about the snake woman. He's saying about Zora. He's saying, oh, did you fuck her? Did you fuck her? Because you basically fucked a washing machine and then turned it off, as in killed her.
Yeah, yeah. So this is the thing, the deeper philosophy of is someone human and how do you know they're human and are we all in a simulation? Which, because the Matrix is quite inspired by this, and so it all spins off from here. But the point of, and this is from a Radio 4 podcast that I listen to, when as a human being, when you meet another human being, you don't walk away from that and cogitate, oh yes, that person had a soul. You just know it. And so it's not something that you need to think about. If you need to think about it, that's an issue. But you don't walk away from meeting someone and go, I think they had a soul. Like, you just wouldn't ever think of it like that. So
people have done that to me.
Really? Was it me?
Yeah. Yeah, well done. Well done, Columbo.
So Leon and Roy, just time for a bit of plot. They're on a quest. They want to meet their maker and they need JF Sebastian as their way in. So Pris, she tricks her way in to the weirdest, most amazing apartment building you've ever seen in your life. There's no need whatsoever for JF Sebastian to make toys and keep toys, apart from the fact that it's thematically perfect. It's the brilliantest smash of old and new that I've ever seen. It looks cool as fuck and it makes it memorable forever.
It looks like Terry Gilliam designed that apartment. Yeah, it's a very Gilliam-esque room.
So very, very, very much.
But you know why they used it? Is because Ridley Scott loved 500 Days of Summer. And it's the Bradbury building, which we discussed a few weeks ago.
The whole look of that film, it is timeless, like, as you said on the episode.
I did, actually. You did. It's kind of those 40s clothes. But I looked up Bradbury building. So it's in Chinatown, Wolf, Disclosure, a lot of films we're going to do, Lethal Weapon 4, Pay It Forward, What Women Want, and The Artist.
We should 100% do What Women Want.
Because I can't remember who it was. Because Ridley Scott had never shot in LA before, and he was like, I want to use the Bradbury building. And I can't remember, one of his American co-workers was like, you do not want to use that building. It's been in a shit ton of movies. Please don't put that on camera. And Ridley Scott was like, not the way I've shot it.
What if I put this spooky fucking marionette in it?
Put big done.
That comes up in the Kermode documentary, where also Kermode mentions that apparently the Bradbury building was inspired by messages that the architect received from an Ouija board.
Cool!
That's a movie.
Love it!
Yep.
So at this point, which controversially...
Cat noises. Don't forget the cat noises. When JF Sebastian turns round after Pris has convinced him to let her in, and he's all smiling because he's like, ooh, a girl's coming into my apartment. And then she looks at him and he goes, whoa.
Bad. Her intentions are bad.
Yeah.
So at this point in director's cut, final cut, Deckard has his unicorn dream. Doesn't seem to mean much, will pay off later. So we'll kind of leave it there for now.
Was it? I couldn't find it. Is it just old footage from Legend? It must have been. Right?
It looks it, doesn't it? Because Ridley Scott's obsessed with unicorns.
Was Legend before this?
No, it was
maybe
after.
Not. Oh, okay.
But so it wasn't footage.
It wasn't footage from Legend, but
so he made Legend because he shot some unicorn footage for Blade Runner.
That's correct.
That way around.
I talked about it on the Legend one. Yeah, that was it. It was
I wasn't here.
But you listened.
Yes, I did. It was great, actually.
Thank you.
Carry on. What was it? Tell me, what did you say that I've just forgotten from being on that episode?
Yeah, test footage that he used on this was right. Sort of what helped inspire some of the Legend stuff.
Okay. Because he loves unicorns. So Deckard is going to do some detective-ing. So he ends up at Taffy Snake Pit Bar. I think he booty calls Rachel, if I'm being perfectly
totally.
Honest. Yeah, and she's 100%. Like, not interested.
That is a shithole. I'm not coming down there.
He's a bit pissed, isn't he? Because he's had a drink that he didn't want. And so I think, Drunken darling.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
I was just in this bar thinking about you.
Yeah, you want to come down? No.
What you doing? I can see it. It's awful. It is an awful place.
I'll see you later instead.
Has he done his...
Oh, that's... Yeah, sorry.
Yes, he has done that.
That's a close-up. I do like
weirdly,
that.
I remember that scene more than any other scene almost
in
this movie.
I would imagine it's not a very good scene now if you're a young person watching this, because you can do most of that on your phone.
It
but
long,
it just... It was in 1981. It was like, what?
It was amazing.
How's he looking all around a photo?
It's one of the few things that I remember from watching it as a kid and going, oh my God, he zoomed into a mirror and found an image. Oh my God.
Well, let's talk about the tech briefly, because I was watching this when most of the tech was kind of available, but video calling, smart homes, he talks to his own home, pinch zoom, kind of. What else? We don't have hover cars. we don't quite have androids.
We do have other cars. Do not we? In mass production yet.
You've got one.
They've got flying taxis that they're trialling in Dubai.
Oh, really?
There are sex bots now as well, aren't there?
There are sex bots. Yeah. I read that, but I've never seen a sex bot.
They're always on. There's always one on the news, some freaky looking robot. They go, look at this.
Literally.
You want to fuck it?
I think Channel 4 get pitched a sex doll documentary every other week. They're massive in Japan.
Of course they are. Yeah. Deku's going to confront Zora, the snake dancer. This is a fun fact. The equivalent scene in the book is that she's an accomplished opera singer. So make of that what you will.
But so she gets changed from an opera singer in the book to a sexy dancer in this.
A sexy naked dancer, yeah.
It really, really, really still. I remember finding it weird the first time I saw it as a kid. And every subsequent time, it's made me more and more sad watching Zora die.
Yeah. It's not good.
No.
I know it's not meant to be, but...
But what's her story? She's part of the gang who's a slave who's escaped to Earth.
Yeah.
Why has she gone and back and worked in a sex club? Well, maybe that's all she can do, but it just struck me as I feel like she wouldn't do that.
Because you want to lie low.
And interesting as well, she is not listed as when Bryant goes through all the professions of the replicants in the gang at the start. Pris is like your average sort of pleasure model. Mm-hmm. But Zora was part of, in his words, a murder squad. Mm. So she's a soldier, not a pleasure bot.
Yes. So a strange choice.
Yeah.
It is.
But more visually interesting than the opera is her dressed as a snake.
Sure. Yeah, I guess.
And is she in a relationship with Leon as well? I couldn't work that out because when he goes to Leon's apartment and retrieves the photos that eventually lead him to Zora, that's Leon's apartment he's in. And Leon at one point is trying to get those photos back.
Yeah.
Now, there are photos of him as a child, fake memory photos, I'm guessing. Mm-hmm. But I think he's meant to be in a relationship with Zora because he looks heartbroken when he sees her dead.
Yeah.
Maybe so. In which case, good job, Leon. Mm.
Go on her. Go on,
my son. Is that what you meant?
She's a snake.
I thought you meant good job because you've become human because you found love.
What's your girlfriend do for this? She's a sexy dancer. Nice. She's one, Leon.
I think you'll find, Vicky, she takes pleasure from the serpent that once corrupted man.
Yeah.
That sounds awesome.
Does that mean she sticks a snake
up her? I think so.
That's so risky.
I didn't.
Not if you're a replicant. It'll bite the snake off down
true.
There.
Yeah. I hadn't thought of it.
I want her head.
And the snake's a replicant as well. Well, so you probably program it, don't bite me.
So it is essentially a sex toy. All right, fine.
Question about this scene, though. Why is Deckard doing that voice?
What? Do you know what? I forgot. I almost forgot.
Oh, God, it's
horrible. This reminds me of The Last Crusade when he plays Scottish.
Yeah.
Like, hey, I'm the guy.
And he does that voice to the stormtroopers in Star Wars as well. He just shouldn't do impressions in films.
It's so weird.
And equally, in every single sequence, these people don't know your normal voice, so you can use your normal voice. Also... I really want the hairdryer.
It's so stupid.
No, it's not.
Does it do her... Right, this is vain. If it does your full face makeup as well, I'm interested. Otherwise, it's just a massive hairdryer and it doesn't take that long to dry that amount of hair.
So it looks great.
It dries in about 5 seconds.
Yeah, it looks like a right laugh. Mm. It's like the hair dryers we've got now, actually. The hand dryers and the blues.
The truth is, it would not look quite so good on the other side of drying your hair like that. If I went into one of those, I would come out and look... Mad. I'd look
You'd
like
have
a mad
volume.
Person.
That's,
I wonder
that's
what I'd look like after one of them.
Your beard. Huge. Massive beard.
Yeah, like a scouring pad. Bang.
I can't get my pint near my face.
Just it's so easy.
Boing. Gracie pints bounced off again.
Actually, it was a bit like that in lockdown when I let it grow out.
It was huge. Yeah, it was huge.
Bizarre. So, but he shoots Zora in the back. And I did watch the theatrical cut. We do get a bit of voiceover from him here saying he doesn't feel good about shooting a woman in the back.
That's the sort of voiceover that makes me see red. Like, yeah. Harrison, you're an actor. Yeah. Can you look sad? Yeah. Definitely. Okay, you look sad now. Brilliant. It's in the can. Let's
remember, go. Remember, Ridley Scott's directing, so he wouldn't have said any of that to Harrison Ford. He'd have been adjusting a bit of glass on the floor.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, so
what do I do in the scene?
What
do I do in the scene, Ridley? doing the glass. But this is Ridley Scott's whole thing. Ridley Scott, like when I interviewed him for Exodus, and I was like, why'd you pick Christine Bale for this role and Joel Edgerton for this role? And he was like, basically, I just want actors who know what the fuck they're doing so I can concentrate on every other element in the scene. Mm-hmm. Not an actor's director.
No.
He just likes, you know, and his scene, I mean, this is the movie where you understand that about him as director, because every scene is a work of art. Every scene is perfect.
Yeah.
The ashtrays are placed so well.
perfectly beautifully placed ashtrays. I agree. But yes, Harrison Ford does look a bit upset, irrespective of any voiceover. Therefore, he's not a replicant. Because we need to start talking about that, because obviously in the theatrical, it's like, no, he's not. And then later on, Ridley Scott's decided, yes, he is. He's not in the book, so that's his thing.
So the thing is, he could be upset because he's certainly not a Nexus 6 replicant. Mm-hmm. So he could be an advanced model, which we'll talk about on Thursday. But certainly, if he's a replicant, mm-hmm. he could be a replicant with an open-ended lifespan. Which
well, he has to be, because otherwise the sequel doesn't work.
Of course, but he could still be a replicant and exhibit emotions because we don't know what his model is capable of. He's not a Nexus 6.
Yeah.
Because Rachel exhibits emotion as yes. well, and she is definitely a replicant.
If he's a superior model, why is he so weak?
It's a good question, but that could be to fit in more with humans, like, as in, you know, like in the sequel, why can replicants drown? But he's helping that.
Yeah. But why do they have blood? Why do they have bones? What's the point?
But the point is...
Because they're not robots. They're genetically built. So they, you know, it's DNA. It's replicating DNA.
Oh, I see.
But if he is a replicant, he's been built to stop and kill replicants. So yes. why would they make him much weaker than them?
That's true.
It doesn't quite make sense.
I mean, where I was at is I don't think anyone really thought Decker was a replicant when this film came out. I certainly didn't.
Ridley Scott did.
I was a child. Yeah. No, I'm getting there. 92, it was all about he's a replicant now. Yeah. And the people that worked on the film, a lot of them have said Ridley Scott wants to rewrite history now. At the time, he was not saying this. He was not claiming this. This is something he has gone back and sort of said was always baked into it. Whereas actually, no, there was always ambiguity baked into it. And this is what upset Harrison Ford, a lot of people involved with the film, that he's taken away the ambiguity by saying from 92 onwards, it's a definite and it always has been.
Yeah.
When that's not how Harrison Ford played it. Yep. And it actually makes it gives him no arc. He's got a very good arc otherwise, Harrison Ford's Deckard. So I can see the frustration. It's so interesting, though, the fact that through all these interviews, it's about 50-50 for the people who made the film what they think, which is fantastic, I think. I mean, it makes it more interesting.
Yep. And the sequel carries on that, doesn't it? They still don't provide us with any answers.
Yeah. Oh, God, let's not talk about the sequel yet.
But what did Ridley Scott say on the 2007 commentary? He goes, he's a replicant, and if you don't realise that, you're a fucking moron.
Harrison Ford.
Harrison Ford. Someone told him that line. I think it was a GQ interview he did. Someone said, Ridley Scott says this, and he's like, you know, I'm happy to be a moron. Morons pay to get in. Still don't know what that means.
What does that mean?
I've no idea. You kind of want to believe Harrison Ford hasn't just put some words together and actually knows what it means, but he actually says morons pay to get in.
Cool.
In the same interview, Ridley Scott goes, the thing about Harrison is he just doesn't tolerate people very well because he's so intelligent. Morons pay to get in.
That's very funny. So next to die is Leon. But then Rachel saves Rick. And she's got a silly coat on, so we're sticking with this silly coat theme. So this is the big thing I want to talk about. So we all go back to his place, and Deckard has a nap while Rachel plays the piano.
Carefully timed nap when she goes, have you ever taken the Voight-Kampff test? Wow, because that would have actually been a really useful answer.
Maybe he's programmed to go to sleep when everyone asks him.
Except that if other people knew that, if replicants he was hunting knew that and he was about to shoot them, he'd go, Voight-Kampff test!
This is going to become relevant on Thursday, but a friend of mine interviewed Harrison Ford and asked him about The Force Awakens, and Harrison Ford just pretended to go to sleep in the interview.
Right.
Oh, yeah. Just shut his eyes and started snoring.
Cool.
Rude.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You should. There's a thing where the GQ people, I did this big deep dive on this GQ interview. It was for Blade Runner 2049, which is why I was doing it. And there's a video of him answering questions. And clearly the person interviewing him is off camera, but they've just not done their research about what Harrison Ford will talk about. Mm-hmm. And so they've had to put Harrison Ford, legend, star of this, star of that. Man, a few words on screen to go, we were in control of this. And that the reason he goes, no.
Oh, no.
Yeah. To their questions, like, which do you prefer, Han Solo or Indiana Jones? I don't know. That's it. That's your answer.
Okay.
Great video.
Great content, guys. So, Rachel is leaving.
You know,
leaving.
I don't have any time for Harrison Ford.
No, I know.
I had this experience.
I know. And
it's a shame.
I do think about it a lot.
Because... I lost a lot of childhood movies.
Yeah.
Never meet your idols.
Never meet your idols. And I will never meet him. But I get it for you two that it's been, you've met him, haven't you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and we'll talk about it on Thursday.
It's a horrible experience.
Well, Chris had a great time with him.
No, is that true?
Yeah,
it's just you. He's got beef with.
Yeah, no, me and everyone else. Apart, Chris is special.
Wow.
Chris is the one who he goes,
like Keanu Reeves for
I
you.
Like you, kid.
you can stay.
You don't ask dumb questions like the rest of these
people.
On one
of the days I interviewed, I was told afterwards by the people running the room that I was the only person that made him smile and laugh.
In his whole life?
In the day. Across, wow. Across 8 hours.
Does his wife know? God. Well, that's amazing. Good for you, Chris.
Have you watched Ally McBeal? I'm fucking hilarious.
That's a Calista Flockhart impression there.
It was really good.
I dug deep.
You watch fucking Ally McBeal.
We've been here a long time, Alex. Please stop.
You're nervous because I'm about to say that Rick Deckard is a rapist, and so you don't want to talk about
it. Oh, no, I actually dug up loads on this because okay. It's even worse when you read the stories behind it, but go on.
So, Rachel's trying to leave. He throws her against the window, and then he coerces her. So he tries to validate it in his head, I think, by making her say things that he wants to hear. So that it could be thought that she's kind of asking for it, because he makes her say, kiss me, and then off we go.
Do it again. Say this again.
Say this again. So I thought, right, let's look at it one way. It could be from the noir, where you have that sort of thing going on, and it's kind of passes unmentioned because it was a different time, quote marks. It could be a very blunt way of exploring how he feels about replicants. But this is coming off the back of a scene where he shot a woman in the back. So it's two negative beats for your ostensible, whether your hero is a bad guy or whatever, but your protagonist. But also, she's not real. So his attitude might be, you can do what you want.
She's a dishwasher. Can you sexually assault a dishwasher?
Fine, I understand that. But then why do you want her to want it? If she's a dishwasher, what does it matter? If she's essentially a sex toy, why do you want her to want it? So,
well, that's why you have these sex toys that go, give it to me. Oh, do that. Because that's what they do. They have sex toys, like dolls that actually talk back to the person having sex with them because right. It makes it more real.
Okay.
More human than human.
Okay. So, but she doesn't want it. And so then you, Rick Deckard, you're so desperate to think that any of this is real that you're making her say what you want to hear, even though you know she isn't real. Like, so it's very knotty and complicated. But I just think in terms of, looking at it at its most basic level, script-wise, two negative beats for your protagonist is not a good idea.
I think reading around it sounds awful as well, because Harrison Ford didn't apparently like Sean Young very much on this shoot and hadn't spoken to her hardly at all in the build-up to this scene. And then they shoot this scene and it's just not a nice. It's when he throws her against the wall, she actually hurt her back, and the tears were real. She
brilliant.
It's quite an unpleasant scene to watch, and it's quite an unpleasant scene to read about.
Yeah, she said. Sean Young said in an interview, 22 maybe or 21. Ridley Scott wanted me to date Harrison and I never would. I was like, nah. Which I quite like. But she thinks it was Ridley Scott sort of directing the scene like that as a fuck you to her for not getting on with Harrison Ford, which is all her fault apparently.
Yeah.
And like that to me is so, it's so upsetting. It's so gross. Like, if that's true, you've directed that scene as a sort of revenge, and then you've gone home and just thought, oh, it was a good day's work.
I don't know. It's impossible to say, but yeah, that could really be a possibility. What did she say? She said, Young said, I did hit my back pretty hard and I did cry a lot, but I think it was exactly what Ridley wanted.
Lovely.
It's like that scene in Rocky we talked about, though.
What's it?
Where Adrian tries to leave the apartment, he goes and shuts the door. And
oh, yeah, I hated that.
Mm.
Yeah.
We all did.
Yeah.
It was amazing. I watched this with my mum and she was like, oof.
That's not good.
This isn't nice. No. This is an unpleasant scene.
Yeah. Mm. And there's another way of doing it, but we'll get to it later, where you still get some sort of weird voyeurism, but it's just not as nasty. So let's meet the good guy of the movie, Roy, again. Hooray. So he's at JF's place.
Not acting like a good guy, if I'm honest.
No.
I mean, I think that's the brilliance of the end of this film. He's actually horrible, frightening, evil, intimidating all the way through this movie, but because he gets that last scene, you fall in love with him. But I mean, he's torturing this guy pretty much.
Yes.
Yeah, he's
mentally and then physically.
You're absolutely right. It's a massive switcheroo from like gouging people's eyes out to going, look at this dove.
Yeah, he acquires the dove, doesn't he? So Roy needs to get to Tyrell for these 4 years are up. So he gets to ascend, goes up the pyramid to meet his maker. I think the dialogue's amazing. Mm. So when Tyrell says to him, like, what seems to be the problem? And he says, death. It's like, that's brilliant.
So many good lines.
I want more life.
I want more life. So what line did you hear in your version here? He says, I want more life.
Mm.
In my version, he says, I want more life, fucker.
No, it wasn't
interesting. No. which is quite an unexpected line.
Oh, and he calls him father.
I was going to say, there's a version, I believe, where he says, I want more life, father.
That's what he said in the one I heard.
Which is an interesting, which is different to what was originally said then.
Yeah. Wow.
Interesting.
That's it's weird.
More of a cartoon villain.
I prefer him saying father, though, because also it works, doesn't it, thematically. Where fucker, it's just weird seeing him say fucker, to be honest.
And every time I watch this, I forget that he kills J.F. Sebastian because you don't see it on screen.
Oh, yeah.
It's so sad.
Well, the thing is, so just to delve into the morals? No, philosophy of it a little bit. Isn't being human only possible when you know that there is a limit? That so you know you're going to die. If you read, so Tyrell says to Roy, the light that burns twice as bright burns half as long. But that's true for all human beings. Like our lifespan is whatever it is, but it could be twice that. But once you actually understand on a bodily level rather than an intellectual level that you are going to die, you do tend to kick things up a gear and try and live your life within its limits, but try and live fully. So to want to never die, doesn't that negate the idea of becoming human? It's quite a robot thing to want, because the fact that we die is what makes life.
He doesn't want to not die, though. He just wants more than 4 measly years.
Sure.
That's all it is. He's like, 4 years isn't enough. You know, he's only just started to experience the emotions that are seeping through. So as those emotions hit him and he becomes more human and he wants to experience that for longer.
Yeah.
And does he blame Sebastian for his plight at all?
I think anyone who says the words, I was involved in making you, is pretty much dead in this movie.
Right. Fair enough. Because if it was just about getting to Tyrell, then it's quite cruel to then kill Sebastian after the fact.
Yeah. Yep.
But if it's got deeper meaning to him, then I guess it makes sense.
But also because he's realised he's not going to get what he wants. And so I think he thinks, well, fuck it then, because he obviously quite enjoys it. Killing someone. So these are Hampton Fancher's words. He puts his master's eyes out. Doesn't have to do it like that. Can kill him any way he wants. So there's pleasure in that. And then I think Roy thinks, he's not going to get his life extension. So he's just going to go after J.F. Sebastian because he enjoys it.
I think the eyes thing as well is blinding him, because obviously
it's biblical.
Neander Wallace is blind in the sequel. And I think it's to do with these huge sort of like tech moguls that are these characters, just being blind to the potential of what replicants could be and just seeing them as a slave labor force.
It's also another example of what a bad cop Deckard is, a bad Blade Runner, because he should have gone to Sebastian. He should have figured this out, followed this trail. He should be there before. Sebastian shouldn't be dead. As it is, I'm not even sure he knows who Sebastian is when it comes over the radio that Sebastian's been killed.
Mm. Yeah.
So he's just not very good at his job.
Yeah. So we go back to J.F. Sebastian's, and again, just to spend more time in that apartment, I love that. There's a thing in the book called Kipple. Do you know about Kipple? So because it's a post-apocalyptic, so it's a post-war environment, and there's just stuff everywhere, so it's called Kipple, and people are really scared of Kipple, excuse me.
Well, Kipple is just the junk in his apartment.
Yeah, so it's stuff that's become useless. But because the world is empty, that's what's different about Blade Runner, this film version and the book. In the book, there are not very many people left because the war has displaced everyone. So everyone's basically gone to Mars, and on Earth, there aren't that many people.
What war?
It's called the Internations War.
Okay.
It's not explained who it is. It's just a big bad war on Earth.
And this is in the book, though, not in the
film.
Isn't it called World War Terminus?
Yes, it is. That is what it's called.
There we go.
So everyone's gone to Mars.
I haven't even read the book. I just pulled that out of thin air.
Yeah.
It's just a guess. Do you want a name for your movie? Blade Runner, mate.
You can have that. So anyway, there's Kipple everywhere because there's no people. And so people are scared of, like, it's entropy. They're aware that when they're gone, the world will just, everything will just degrade, and the, you know, organic sort of plants will take over and all the rest of it. So people are scared of stuff. And in this version, J.F. Sebastian's apartment, it's true to the version of the book in that there's Kipple everywhere. So I quite liked that.
And he can't go off world because of his genetic disease, his glands.
So in the book, it's it's a pejorative term, but he self-identifies. He's called J.I. Isidore, and he calls himself a chicken head because he's got mental limitations, and so he's not allowed to go.
Right.
And so there's a substrata of human beings that aren't allowed to go.
Because I always thought off-world wasn't pleasant, but in both these movies, off-world is paradise.
Yeah.
Well, no, we're told it's paradise.
Okay.
I think there might be a story to be told off-world when actually maybe that isn't the truth.
Oh, you don't have to do that. Soldier did that. Paul W.S. Anderson already handled that in his film Soldier.
Which was a sequel, wasn't it? It was
a sidequel.
Hampton Fancher wrote it, didn't he?
Yeah. Hampton Fancher wrote it. Ridley Scott exec produced and directed a few scenes as well.
And it was a disaster.
That's Soldier, 1998 Soldier, directed by Ridley Scott.
Great. Thanks, Alex. So professional. So anyway,
Lucy's... David Peoples did write Soldier.
Sorry, David Peoples, yeah.
Oh, I thought you were doing a joke.
No.
Oh, yeah, no.
One of them did.
David Peoples. David Peoples.
Come on, we're so
Soldier.
Close to the end.
All right, so this is what we came for. We want a show.
There we go. We've hit the 1 hour, 15 minute mark. Dad's come out.
It's... I'm really hot.
I know you are. It's the beard.
So we need a showdown between our rapey hero and a man just trying to get by, just trying to live.
Yeah, if Deckard's a replicant, he drops his gun a lot in this film. Surely they haven't built that into replicants that you can't hold a gun.
So Roy's facing the end. He starts howling like a wolf. He drives a nail through his hand. So the first time I watched this, I was like, you do that because you're trying to keep yourself present, because this is because I'm an idiot. So he's reaching the end, and obviously pain brings you to your senses. But then again, when you're reading around it, it's like, or is it because he thinks he's Jesus? And so it's stigmata. I don't know.
Yeah, he's. I think he's more meant to be Lucifer, isn't he? He's like he's Milton's Lucifer. He's the fallen angel who's returned to take vengeance on his master, yeah. God, thought, in this case, Tyrell.
I thought it was his sort of limbs seizing up, and that it was the end of his life. But also, I mean, it does draw a parallel between the two of them because they both injure their hands in this fight. Yeah. So that's quite...
I think the fight is good. I love crashing through the apartment because I like the apartment. I like the fact that Roy is naked, but then it upsets me when I notice he's wearing trainers and socks. So it's like, if you're going to be naked, take it all off. Don't just leave your socks on because there's glass.
He's not totally naked. He's got...
Oh, he's got pants on.
Tight shorts. Yeah.
But do you know what I mean? Like, why has he got his shoes and socks on?
I think it's a strong look. I mean, you close your eyes, as I often do.
Is that
do,
what
think,
you look like on
and,
holiday?
And think Roy Batty, and I'm like, yeah. Naked guy, apart from very tight shorts and ice white shoes. He's Alan Partridge. Ice white socks, ice white shoes.
If it's this hot,
jumper
next
over
week,
the shoulders.
I'm wearing that.
Are you? Okay, cool. That's
totes. Fine. Well, you won't be here.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, spoiler alert.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
Come on.
Sorry. So anyway, so Roy, you can't stave off the end. And this is fun. So although Deckard hates him, he has to listen to him, which is good, because Roy's dying speech is impressive for a human, but let alone a robot. Alex, you've already done a very fine impression of it at the top of the show, so I won't do it again.
No, really?
No need. Don't need.
Don't give it a shot.
No, absolutely not.
It's interesting when you read the versions and how it changed, obviously, from the initial version that Peoples wrote to then his new version that he wrote to the version that Rutger Hauer actually cut down and did himself, the one that we see in the movie. Mm. It is tremendous what Rutger Hauer did to that speech. I'm not going to bore you by reading them now, but you should look them up online. The original speech that he was given, that he cut down. For example, he says, I've seen things you little people wouldn't believe, which just changes the whole thing, as opposed to I've seen things you people wouldn't believe, because he's like, he's self-aggrandizing. He's talking down to you, and you wouldn't love him as much if he said you little people talking about humans.
But then doesn't Love say that in 2049? Doesn't that come back? Doesn't she say you little people?
Possibly.
Maybe, I can't remember. So anyway, it's all over for Roy, and then Gaff is back. And he's talking about Rachel to Deckard. He says, it's too bad she won't live, but then who does? Which I love that. That's a brilliant line. But she's not dead. She's just sleeping with her clothes over her head. The little tease.
Weirdo.
Yep.
Odd thing to do. Who does that? No one. Oh, that should be the test. Don't do a Voight Kampff test. Watch them sleep.
Yeah.
She's got covers over her head. Replicants. Right there. The one with the covers over the head. That one. That would be a great test at the start. If Leon had walked in and Holden had just tucked a sheet over him, and he'd have gone, oh, that's lovely. Oh,
dead.
Replicant.
Dead. So the man who hates replicants asks a replicant, do you love me? Do you trust me? And then they make their escape. Who are they escaping from? Just, I've forgotten. They're on the run. From who? She's
well,
can't be killed.
Gaff. I think Gaff is one of them. And because why has Gaff put that origami unicorn out there?
Am I going to get you?
Yeah, I'm fucking with you.
Well, yeah. What is he saying there? Is he saying she's a unicorn? She's one of a kind. She's one of the next models. She won't die. Is he saying she's not one of those people? She's going to die. I'm letting you go because she's the end is nigh for her. Or obviously with the dream version, is he saying, I know that you're a replicant.
But even if he is saying, I know you're a replicant, it's not necessarily a threat.
Yeah.
He's actually, if Deckard hadn't worked it out at that point, he's actually giving him a nudge over the side, edge, and going, look, go and be happy because you're a replicant too.
That's what I think. I don't think it's a sad ending. I'm surprised that people found it so much of a downer in the 80s.
Gaff's a bit of an enigma to me. Like, I don't know whether he hates Deckard or he respects Deckard or he knows something about Deckard that Deckard doesn't know. If Gaff is a replicant himself, I just, like, because he's a Blade Runner as well. I'm assuming, I don't think it's ever said, like, outright. But Gaff, I don't know what to make of him.
No, I don't.
Which is great.
It's quite fun in a noir sense, yeah. Sort of mystery helper.
Well, people in the 80s didn't like the ending because it was a happy ending. They thought it was too happy.
Oh, okay, yes.
Yeah, because they're going off into this, suddenly we're seeing this beautiful landscape.
Yeah.
And the ending they originally had was those elevator doors closing. But them going off into the sunset, I think Ridley Scott since said it was, people just thought it was improbable. Mm. It just seemed to undermine this story we were telling.
You undermine the world. You've been so in exactly. that world, and the world is dark. And so suddenly being, you know, sunlight, it's...
It's the visuals. It's the visuals that spoil it, because you just like, this feels like it's cut from a different film entirely.
Which it is.
Yeah.
So
just a couple of bits, though, on that original 82 version. After the amazing speech from Rutger Hauer, we get voiceover.
Yeah, we do. I've got the voiceover.
Do you want to say it then?
Yeah, I can't believe how... Just hang on. Just let me scroll through my millions...
This is voiceover from who? Rutger Hauer?
No, Deckard.
Oh, right.
The Deckard voiceover.
Brackets voiceover. I don't know why he saved my life. Maybe in those last moments, he loved life more than he ever had before.
Which is exactly what Harrison Ford's face is telling us and what Rutger Hauer's just telling us.
Not just his life, anybody's life, my life. All he'd wanted were the same answers the rest of us want. Oh, fuck me. Where did I come from? Where am I going? How long have I got? All I could do was sit there and watch him die. All I could do from that point on, that's great. But I mean, talk about fucking smashing someone over the head
It's honestly the worst bit, because I, as I say, I watched the actual cut this week. It's the worst bit of voiceover in the movie, because it just ruins that moment of stillness and beauty.
Mm. Yeah.
But we also get voiceover in this very final scene when the doors close on the elevator. Deckard says, Gaff had been there and let her live. 4 years, he figured. He was wrong. Tyrell had told me Rachel was special. No termination date. I didn't know how long we'd have together. Who does? And it's just, again, it's just, I mean, they got rid of all of it. They got rid of the voiceover and the imagery eventually. And I think it's a vastly improved ending.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. I mean, you got a feel for Harrison Ford, though. Like, it sounds awful. Like, when he was presented with the voiceover that was written by neither of the writers who'd worked on it, and he's in a voiceover booth, and initially Bud Yorkin was there, and then on the final time where they were like, this is going to be the version, it was just him and the guy who'd written the voiceover.
Oh, God.
And Harrison Ford says there was no one to turn to go, can we maybe think about this? Because it was just me and him, and he wasn't going to budge on what he'd written. And so I just had to read it. And I read it 5 times and said, pick what you want, and left.
And the point is, the voiceover was there in Hampton Fancher's script. Initially, there was voiceover. There was one in David Peoples' scripts. They had voiceovers that they eventually excised. And those were subtle voiceovers that weren't really giving you information. They were setting the scene, like 1940s noir voiceovers. And then what it changed into, they got rid of it, and then they decided they need it at the last minute. That TV writer came in and it suddenly was explaining stuff.
Mm. Yeah.
And that's the issue. Of it's course. Just, you Ooh. Know, it's treating the audience like it's an idiot.
Hello, idiots. Let me tell you what's going on. She's going to live forever and we're quite happy. Roy was happy as well at the end. Did you get that? Bye-bye.
Yes, that's exactly it.
In that Kermode interview, he's at the end, Ridley Scott says, when Harrison's on his piano, he's a bit drunk. We go into the unicorn. That was the only reference to this abstract image. Then he finds the unicorn on the floor at the end. Kermode says, what does that mean? Scott says, it means he's a replicant.
Mm.
Yeah.
Simple as.
Moron! It means he's a replicant, Mark, you moron! How have I not been clear about this? He's a fucking replicant!
That's it. Would you like to do the bits?
For sure.
Brilliant. Chris, what would you say your best scene was?
Time to die. I mean,
do you like that?
No, the time to die at the end. Yeah, it's Rutger Hauer's speech.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh,
I thought you meant
Leon.
Yeah.
Not Leon saying that.
There's a sample used on a Popular Eat Itself song called "Wake Up, Time to Die."
Yeah.
Wake up, time to die. mine is absolutely Roy Batty's speech at the end. I genuinely cried this time. It's always hit me, but this time I don't know what's happened. Maybe because I understand the movie better, being a bit more grown up, you'd think. But genuinely, tears, real tears. It's such a beautiful moment.
It is also my best scene.
It's the visuals that he creates. Like, you are sort of there with him. You are witnessing in your head, however you imagine it, attack ships ablaze off the shoulder of Orion.
Yeah.
And I will say, I know you talked about Philip K. Dick seeing footage and liking Rachel, but the editor said he showed him an early cut of the film, which was just before Dick died. He died just before the film came out. And he said, at the end of it, Philip K. Dick turned to him and said, how is that possible? This feels exactly like what I had in my head when I wrote it.
Mm.
Which is a lovely thing that they all got to hear before, because Philip K. Dick had hated this film so much, you know, that he wasn't involved. He called it Get Smart with Robots. He hated it. And then the fact that he saw it and loved it before the end, I think means a lot.
Mm. Yeah, I think it's very generous as well. It's obviously a brilliant film, but I think if you were a writer, you have every right to kind of expect, you may be wrong, but you would expect that a film adaptation of your book would look like your book, as in terms of would have the key story beats, and it absolutely does not. Mm. Not, I mean, I know we joked about there being no electric sheep, but the beats are broadly the same, but the whole story is completely different. And you would be like, oh, okay, did you not like any of that stuff? Like, what you've done is lift the central conceit and that's kind it. Of do what you want with it.
Which one do you think is the better story?
I think the film is the best story.
Okay.
Yes, I do. Good. All right, so you're most valuable, whatever, Alex.
So much of me does want to go for Rutger Hauer for the work that he says was minimal that he did. He just cut down the big speech at the end and added, like, the one contribution he says he made was, I added all those things, all those memories will be lost, like tears in the rain. That was his addition, which arguably is the best part about the speech. But I'm not giving it to Rutger Hauer because I gave him his speech as the best scene. It's a combination of Ridley Scott, concept artist, visual futurist Sid Mead, production designer Lawrence G. Paul, art director David Snyder, Douglas Turnbull and Richard Urerich, special effects supervisors, Mark Stetson, the chief model maker, basically everyone who had a part in realising Los Angeles 2019 as we see it in that film. Everyone who had a part in that. I guess mainly Ridley Scott and Sid Mead because they came up with the visuals and what they wanted to do. But it's just the most beautiful, beautiful world. I played a lot of, it's a role-playing game called Shadowrun when I was a teenager. And it's set in this cyberpunk kind of world. And for all of us playing that game, when you imagine it in your head, you are imagining Blade Runner. Mm. And it gave us that. And for that, I'm eternally grateful. So that is my most valuable whatever.
That's lovely. What about you?
Shout out to James Hong. We didn't mention him.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. He's here. Yeah. I just do eyes.
as Hannibal Chu. So I had Sid Mead down. And then I read that Cine Fantastique article from 82, and production designer Lawrence Paul is absolutely apoplectic with rage that Sid Mead is taking all the credit for everything. And he said, this was a team effort. I did a lot. My team did a lot. It wasn't all this guy. So I've dropped Sid Mead and I'm going to pick Rutger Hauer.
Yay!
because it does elevate the movie, what he brought to it at the end. And it's interesting, that quote that you mentioned about him talking about the dishwasher, he goes on to say, he sort of slags off Harrison Ford a bit, which I think is quite interesting. He says, his role didn't seem to fit him. He couldn't make it fit. If he had been stronger, I would not have been so shiny. Oh. So he blames the success of his performance on Harrison Ford.
Being a bit shit.
Yes.
Cool.
Classic Hauer.
So my MVW zeroes in because I just thought I can because I want to, and it's just literally JF Sebastian's apartment. Everything I love about this film is in that apartment. So the smash of the old and the new, the dilapidation, the degradation, the grandeur, the glamour, the fucking weirdness, the unnecessary attention to detail, everything I like about this film is in there.
And a man getting strangled between Daryl Hannah's thighs.
Forgot about that. That's a big complaint for me. Like, I just
her death, Pris's death, is nasty. Where
she's a fucking idiot. If you flip at someone, exposing your major organs, they're gonna get a shot in. Like, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, she's a pleasure model though, so she wasn't prepped for combat.
Why does she know gymnastics? Oh wait, yeah.
Clear the cogs turning there.
Let's go top shelf it and then use it just after this. I'll show you some things.
Razzle a clock.
Yeah, all right then. All right, one change.
Top shelf it. Carry on. I'm working on a catchphrase.
Top shelf. Okay, fine. Right.
Come on, we've been in 90 minutes.
Sorry, what's your change? You, Chris.
You do it fast as well.
I kind of touched on this earlier, but I think you've got to make Rachel a more interesting character. She's the next model. Make her charismatic. Make her funny. Make her likable. I've got no idea why he's in love with her.
Yeah.
His arc at the end is he finds his humanity through his love for her.
Mm.
But I don't see why he's in love with her. She's just nothing. She's just this vessel. And so I think it's a big flaw with the movie because I don't understand why he's doing what he's doing.
Unless you watch a sequel called Blade Runner 2049, which then talks about the fact that he may have been designed, programmed, created by Tyrell to fall in love with Rachel because he's a replicant. So there's that argument.
What's your change?
My change is there's a scene, and I've mentioned it three times, and why not have it as the change? Because I do think the Final Cut is a beautiful movie. It's a perfect movie, in my opinion, apart from the Holden Hospital scene where Deckard visits him in the hospital. It provides just so much more fascinating ideas around the idea of humans, these replicants, and Holden is very vicious about replicants. He's disgusted by them and he's threatened by them, and Deckard isn't so much, and they have a very interesting conversation while he's in this machine. It's a beautiful shot as well. It's online. You should watch it, and I really want that scene back in, because there's also a bit of that scene where Gaff and Bryant are watching Deckard have this conversation with Holden, and then they talk about what Deckard's saying in a way that makes you sort of, it doesn't answer any questions, but the ambiguity it delivers, you can tie it to certain interesting themes.
But doesn't it undermine the story if the machine isn't working?
Which machine?
The Kampf machine. Didn't you say that in that scene he says that he wasn't getting the right readings from the machine?
Oh, no, but the suggestion there is that Leon, because he's this advanced model, like Holden says, the machines can't even tell anymore because they've become so human. They're right. Basically here to replace us.
But that doesn't undermine it working on Rachel then?
But it takes 100 and whatever questions.
Right. Sure, no, fair enough.
We've got to change that sex scene because it's not good. So here we go. So Rachel, she's a robot. She realises she has desire, which therefore makes her human. But she has desire for a man who's been mean to her because he very casually told her she's a robot. Confliction, okay? Then you've got a man who doesn't know he's a replicant, desiring a replicant. Why? Conflict. There you go. That's it. That's the sex scene. No more rape.
No, agreed.
Sexy.
Agreed. You can make that sexy.
I could just hear you read that.
If I'd have known, I would have done it differently.
Yeah, but it's audio cassettes and the newsagents. Top shelf fits. Proper top shelf stuff.
I'll add that during my research, I found out that they storyboarded a scene with a gorilla in a business suit working as a bouncer. So get that in.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's quite Roger Rabbit. Yeah.
Okay, fine.
I think that's it.
All right, we're done. Do you want to do a quiz, Chris?
Yes, and right. I have a feeling this one might be a draw. Alex, first question is directed to you.
Great. Someone
someone gives you a calfskin wallet for your birthday. How do you react?
I refuse to take the gift because I am appalled that an animal would have been used to make something like a wallet.
Okay. Within sales interlinks. Vicky. Your little boy shows you his butterfly collection.
Yes.
Plus the killing jar.
Yes.
What do you say?
I take him to the doctor.
Within cells interlinked. Alex, you're watching television. Suddenly you spot a wasp crawling on your arm. How do you react?
I kill it. Cells interlinked.
Kill it. Vicky,
yep.
While walking along a desert sand, you suddenly look down and see a tortoise crawling toward you. You reach down and flip it over onto its back. The tortoise lies there, its belly baking in the hot sun, beating its legs, trying to turn itself over, but it cannot do so without your help. You are not helping. Why?
Is the answer why cells interlinked?
No, it's what's a tortoise?
Oh yeah, what's a tortoise? Cells interlinked.
Alex.
Yep.
You're reading a magazine.
Oh, that's handy.
You come across a full-page nude photo of a girl or guy. Mm. You show it to your husband, wife, who likes it so much, she hangs it on your bedroom wall.
Mm.
The girl/guy is lying on a bearskin rug.
Mm. Cells interlinked.
Okay. Final one. Vicky.
Yes.
React to this. You're watching a stage play. A banquet is in progress. The guests are enjoying an appetizer of raw oysters. The entree consists of boiled dog stuffed with rice. The raw oysters are less acceptable to you than a dish of boiled dog.
Oh, where do they eat dogs? There's a line, the line in the book is really funny. She says, where do they eat dogs? And he says, in the Philippines. And she says, he wants to watch a movie set in the Philippines, which is very funny. I am appalled by the dog. I would report everybody involved and the oysters, actually, as it goes, because I'm allergic to oysters.
That is all I needed. Thank you. The quiz is a draw.
Good.
And Alex is a replicant.
100%.
Yay! Is that good? Great. Yeah. That is us done on Blade Runner. So before we talk about next week, let's talk about next week. We've got another two shows coming up. Chris, it's your week, isn't it? No, Vicky, it's your week.
Did you come up with a clue?
I did. It's really good.
Lovely.
Are you ready?
Right, yeah. Brilliant.
Congratulations on your new arrival. Congratulations on your new arrival, or congratulations on your new Evil Rival.
We changed the films we're doing, so I'll
you
do the quiz.
You didn't tell me that.
Oh, my God. We had a massive conversation about it outside, me and Chris, when you were in the toilet.
Oh, yeah, fine.
I also, it was also on WhatsApp yesterday.
Yeah. Oh, the bloody wasn't. It check. Was.
I'll
go on then, show me.
Do it after. Do it afterwards. Should we cut this out? We'll cut this out.
No, it's fine. It's fine, because it's good to show that we are professional.
Alex, have you got a clue for this?
No.
Okay. Have you got one?
I've got a crap one.
Great, let's do yours.
You've got a better one.
No.
All right. The clue is not your new Arrival.
Because it's Vicky's week. That's why I didn't bring a clue, because Vicky's week. Go on. Just do your clue.
Slobs v Snobs.
Nice. Slobs v Snobs.
Yes.
Yeah, why not? All right, then. That's your clue. Good luck with that. There'll be a better one on Twitter once we've had a think about it.
Yeah,
in the meantime, that is it for this episode. We are back on Thursday talking about Blade Runner 2049 and deciding whether this movie, Blade Runner or Blade Runner 2049, is our victor this week. Until then, please do subscribe to us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. It means a great deal to us. Thank you for listening. Check in with us on Twitter and Instagram at ClashPod. Speak to you Thursday. Bye-bye for now.
This was a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.